This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Coming up later in the show, we'll talk about a possible change in the way public employees get health care in Wisconsin. But first, we're talking to an English professor who made her academic mark studying freaks and freak shows. She studied how people with physical differences were treated and how the world viewed them. When she gave birth to her son Henry, this area of research really came home to her, became extremely personal. Henry was born with Down syndrome. She's written a new memoir about the intersection of her career and her personal life. We want to hear from you. Are you the parent of a child with disabilities, a child who's different in some way that other people might take notice of? What is the reaction you get from people? Does it frustrate you, or do you see a lot of teaching moments out there? What needs to change? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can send an email, talk@wpr.org. Rachel Adams joins us now. She's a writer. She's a professor of English and American Studies at Columbia University. Her new book is Raising Henry, a memoir of motherhood, disability, and discovery. Rachel, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, talk about that academic background a little. Why did you decide to study on freak shows as an area of study?
You know, it was just something that interested me. And I think as I got into the work, I realized for various reasons, I had always felt like something of an outsider myself. And so it spoke to something in me. And I also loved it because it was a way of connecting with other people. I felt like everyone I met had some experience of either going to a freak show or some encounter in their past that made this topic come to life for them.
And freak shows are kind of a freaky idea when you think of it. You're setting humans out as really different and setting them aside and looking at them in a really odd and maybe almost inhuman way.
Exactly. It is all about exploiting the differences of other people for profit and the pleasure of the people who come to see them. And there are some very, very sad stories about the people who performed as freaks. There are also some really fascinating success stories. There were some people whose bodies were so different, there really were no other options for them, and they became sort of free agents and were able to make money and travel the world by exhibiting themselves.
Well, and then you had your second son, Henry, and he was born with Down syndrome. And one of the things you noticed from your academic research, it seems you got a sense, probably a real sense, that people were looking at you and at him differently as somehow outside the norm. What did that feel like?
Well, I have to say first that talking about my previous academic background, that in some ways it prepared me to have this child because I knew a lot about the history and the culture of people with disabilities. And in other ways, it did not prepare me at all because having studied something as an intellectual problem is nothing like confronting it within your own family. And the funny thing about disability is that it happens to all of us if we live long enough. But it seems to always take us by surprise. But I did notice once I had Henry, I had always studied the freak show as something that belonged to the past. And when it was in the present, it happened in these very contained and planned places, like you go to Coney Island and you see a freak show. But I started to find resonances of the freak show dynamic in many of the interactions I had once I had given birth to this child.
So when you're out in public with Henry, what is the perception of people? What kind of reactions did you get that made you really start thinking about this?
You know, having said that, I should say that in general, Henry has been welcomed into the world that we inhabit. He is almost always greeted with you know, appreciation and joy and treated like any other child. I would say the main place where I really felt the dynamics of the freak show were in medical encounters. So dealing with certain kinds of doctors, especially specialists who might know a lot about the medical challenges of a person with Down syndrome, but seem not to have given any thought to the social dynamics and to recognize that they're dealing with a child and a family that surrounds that child.
Let's follow that thread. What are a couple examples of this in action?
Well, there was one geneticist in particular who I first met maybe a day after Henry was born. I was sitting with him in the NICU. They took him to the neonatal intensive care, even though no one was really sure whether there was anything wrong with him, but they wanted to monitor him. So I was sitting there with him, and this geneticist came along on rounds with a group of residents, and he walked right up to my child. No one acknowledged me, and he had them all cluster around in a circle, and he started to point to different parts of my son's body, and he lifted up his arm and let it fall onto the blankets to show that he had low muscle tone, and kind of gesture to these different features as the revealing signs of Down syndrome. And at that moment, I really felt like I couldn't believe we were in the 21st century. It felt like these scenes I had read about in the 19th century, where you would put people on display and you would look at them as objects and you would sort of review different parts of their body as if they didn't belong to a person.
How did it feel as a mom in that room with your child as a kind of living case study?
It felt shocking, and we had subsequent dealings with this geneticist, and I always felt sort of stunned by his lack of empathy and his failure to recognize us as people. But I also felt, in retrospect, sort of disappointed in myself because I never had the self-possession to speak up. I was just so stunned and sort of intimidated. There I was in my pajamas. You know, I had just given birth a day before. And so I think there's often a lack of awareness also about the power dynamic between a doctor who's there as a very highly educated and respected professional and the position that the parent and the patient is in that context. So I never spoke up, and so part of the reason I wanted to write this book was to work through my feelings about those experiences and also hopefully to educate doctors.
Were there happier stories in your encounters with doctors or other healthcare professionals?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I would say there's two different kinds. Like, if I had to group the doctors into two different categories, they're the ones who see a lot of patients of all kinds and have really accepted my son as a person and as a child while being well aware of particular issues that need to be tracked and cared for in a person with Down syndrome. So our pediatrician has been just outstanding, very empathetic, very wise and sensible. We have a very nice eye doctor, a wonderful dentist. So it's the people who are doing this sort of routine on the ground care. I think what I have learned from geneticists and other specialists who are more willing to talk about these things, one of the problems that tends to arise is that their knowledge about Down syndrome comes from working in hospitals where they often see the most gravely ill patients. So you're not just a person with Down syndrome, which is not an illness or a disease, but you also have some complications. And so they have very little understanding of what it means to be a healthy person with a disability and how to recognize that person as a child and as a whole person and not just as a body part, you know, a kidney or an esophagus, but as a whole person who is part of a family and a social world.
Before we leave the topic of the medical profession, do you have advice for parents of a child with Down syndrome or maybe a disability of some other sort, an illness of some other sort of how to advocate and how to deal with that healthcare system if they encounter, you know, their kid being treated as a symptom?
Well, as I said, I think, first of all, you have to be understanding of yourself and your own limitations. So I'm very clear in the book that I was not very good at speaking back in those moments when I was taken off guard. But you do have to educate yourself. There are many different ways to learn about the best practices in care of children and older and adults with Down syndrome. And so you cannot count on your doctors to know what those are. And so you need to go into the doctor more educated than you might need to be if you had a typical child. And so knowing what to ask for to make sure your child is being screened for various conditions that can arise. And then also to know when your child is not, in fact, being treated but is being observed. So there have been doctors that we simply we stopped seeing them because I felt that they were curious about Henry. And they wanted to study him, but I realized over time that they were not actually giving him any treatment that he wasn't receiving somewhere else. And so you can go overboard with the medicalization. We do want the best care for our children, but many of them are quite healthy, and you don't need to see every specialist under the sun. You just need to be educated about what's best for your child, and to remember always that you do know best because you are the parent and you know the child better than anyone else.
We're talking to Rachel Adams. She's the author of Raising Henry, a memoir of motherhood, disability, and discovery, talking about raising her child who was born with Down syndrome. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234 if you have a story, if you're a parent of a child with Down syndrome or a child with a disability. What challenges do you face? What reaction do you get from people in the public? Is there a stupid question you don't want to hear anymore? 800-642-1234 or send an email, talk@WPR.org. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. We're talking to Rachel Adams, writer, professor of English at Columbia University, and the author of Raising Henry, a memoir of motherhood, disability, and discovery. Henry is her second son. He was born with Down syndrome, and we're talking about, a lot of things related to that. And Rachel, just before the break, I mentioned stupid questions. Maybe you don't call them stupid questions, I don't know, but there are questions you've heard a lot that bug you over time. Talk about that a little.
Oh, I was hoping you would ask me that question.
I'm asking you, yep.
Yes.
I didn't want to ask you the stupid questions themselves, though.
Right, of course. I think my least favorite is, didn't you get tested?
Mm-hmm.
So people always want to know how this happened. And I used to be so surprised by it that I would answer them. And I've decided I should say that there's a whole chapter in the book where I discuss my decisions at length, but I've decided I'm not going to answer that question anymore because it's rude. You don't ask the mothers of other children whether they had prenatal testing or what tests they had, and it seems to imply that something's gone wrong, and that if you had had the proper tests or if they had worked in the right way, then someone like me would never have a child like Henry.
Well, there's an assumption there maybe that you would be happier without Henry than with him.
Sure. And what kind of how did this? I think people want to feel like they have control over every aspect of reproduction and parenting. And to me, one of the wonderful lessons of parenthood is just how little control we have over the children that we bring into the world, whether they're disabled or not. We don't get to choose them, and they are their own people from the moment that they come into the world.
That's definitely something I think any parent can relate to, definitely. Well, talk about, I've seen you talk elsewhere about sort of changing our notion of the goals and value of parenthood. I think a lot of people, the assumption, spoken or unspoken, is that successful parenting means you have an independent adult starting at age 18 to 25, somewhere in there. Talk about that a little.
Oh, sure. I also think that a lot of people go into parenting believing that their children will be a reflection of their own brilliance and their talents, And, you know, most of us discover that that's not true. No matter how smart and talented our children are, they're very rarely mirrors of ourselves. And so, I mean, I think any child teaches us to think differently about what it means to be a parent and why we love our children, which may be for very different reasons than an outsider might suspect. But it is true that while we very much hope and expect Henry to be as independent as possible, we can't count on the same kinds of independence that we do with our older son. And so that has caused me to think differently about the life course of my experience as a parent, that I may end up being a caregiver for Henry for longer than usual, and it may be for my entire lifetime. And I don't think that's the worst thing in the world. In fact, it's made me more aware of the ways we're all dependent on other people, and also just all the unpredictable things that can happen to us in life. So I do count on my older son growing up and becoming independent and perhaps moving away, but you just never know what's going to happen. And I think with any child, you can make yourself crazy worrying about a future that is so far down the road that you can't see to it yet.
Well, talking about connections with other people, one of your first thoughts was, I gather, a sense of feeling alone, like you were in this unique position. What happened when you started looking for people to connect to and share this experience?
I felt completely alone. My son was born on December 24th, and so we had the absolute C team in the hospital. And so I think the social worker who worked with us was very new to her job, and she didn't seem to have any advice for me about how I could find other parents or who I could connect with. And so I did feel terribly alone, and I was very worried about the kinds of people that I might be forced into company with in having this child. And so it was a longer process than it might be. I have actually been working with other parents to improve the connections we make with new parents so that they leave the hospital feeling like they have a community. But it took a while, but I called our local chapter of the National Down Syndrome Society, and I met a couple of parents who had volunteered to be contacts. We got our son evaluated for various kinds of therapy, and the therapist put us in touch with other families that we knew. And so slowly I started to build a world, and quite remarkably, I discovered there were two other boys with Down syndrome on our street.
No kidding.
Living in the next block. And I realized I had never seen them before, although I had seen them repeatedly. And it just drove home this point that there are certain things you just don't really notice until they're important to you.
We've just got a couple minutes left. How old is Henry?
So Henry's 5 and a half. He'll be 6 on Christmas.
And I want to get a feeling, what is he into? What kind of things does he like? What does he do?
What is he into? His favorite thing in the world is the Muppets.
Ah.
He will watch the Muppets all day long. I think a lot of the Muppets has quite an adult sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
So some of that is lost on him, but he loves there's the chaos Muppets. He loves the destruction and the zaniness, and he loves the relationship between Miss Piggy and Kermit. And he is a big puppeteer himself. So he'll put a puppet on each hand and he'll walk around and have them talk to each other. And so he's very popular. Often when we ride the subway, we get a whole crowd of other children gathered around him who are really fascinated by this. His other favorite thing is his big brother. So whatever his big brother is into, he wants to be doing that too.
And I think I saw something about Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker.
Oh, well, that's an old. His brother has a new passion every month or so. So now it's baseball season. We're doing fall ball. So there's a lot of baseball playing and talk about the Yankees that goes on in our households.
All right. Well, Rachel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
That was Rachel Adams. She's a writer. She's a professor of English and American Studies at Columbia University. She's the author of Raising Henry, a memoir of motherhood, disability, and discovery. Up next, we'll talk about some potential changes to the way Wisconsin State employees get their health care. It's in the early stages, still a lot of gaps, things we don't know, but we'll get a taste of it coming up. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll set aside the dinosaur glory hounds for a minute. That means you, T-Rex, and spend some time with the unsung heroes of the dinosaur world.
But first, a proposal to change state employee health benefits could be gaining momentum in the state.
According to the Wisconsin State Journal, Governor Walker is meeting with health plan executives today about the possibility of moving from a competitive HMO model to a self-insured program.
Joining us now to explain is one of the authors of that story, David Wahlberg. He's the health and medicine reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. David, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, good to be here.
So did you see this story coming? Was it a surprise for you?
Well, actually, this proposal to switch from the competitive managed care model that the state has used for several years to the self-insured model has been out there for about a year, but it hasn't gotten much attention until recently. And then the fact that the governor met today with some of the heads of the health plans seemed to indicate that it was certainly being taken seriously.
So the governor met today with some of the heads of these health plans. Do you know what happened at that meeting?
I don't. I haven't heard much about what the result of that meeting was.
So in general, how does the HMO model in Wisconsin currently work for state employees?
Right. So there are about 18 HMOs that are available at different parts of the state. So not all of them are available everywhere. But employees in different locations have choices of a few of those. Basically, they pay part of the premium, and then the state picks up the rest. And the idea is that the competition between the HMOs, for example, there are four HMOs that compete quite a bit in Dane County for that business, drives down the rates and theoretically keeps them low for the state.
And so then how would a self-insurance plan work?
Right. So with self-insurance, the state doesn't contract with insurance companies for insurance. It basically pays the bills itself. And as part of that, the state is basically accepting the risk for any really large claims that might be filed. So in some years, that might be a good thing if your costs are low and people don't have a lot of large claims. Perhaps you can save money. But in those years where people get really sick and require lots of expensive treatment, you might potentially lose money. There is some stopgap insurance that can be bought to sort of buffer that, but that would add to the expense.
Do you know how this would affect, you know, people and their pocketbooks?
That's kind of unclear right now. So there's been a couple studies out by Deloitte, the consulting firm, and the most recent one was in August, and it essentially said that going to self-insurance could save about 4 to 5%, partly by avoiding some of the taxes from the Affordable Care Act, or I should say fees from the Affordable Care Act. But the same report says that the current system saves about 4 to 5%. So, you know, that might suggest it would be sort of a wash for the state and for employees. Basically, the report suggested that the Group Insurance Board, which oversees this program for state employees, should really gather some more data, and it might be possible that this could save money, at least in some regions of the state.
Now, it sounds like there are about 20 other states that already follow this self-insurance plan, and I wonder if you have any idea about how they're faring with it.
I don't. That's something I've been trying to get some time to look at and just haven't really had a chance to. I did find out, for example, that our neighbor to the west, Minnesota, does this, but I don't know much about what the result has been.
So what has been the reaction so far to this?
Well, I don't know. I guess, you know, we've gotten quite a few comments on our story online, for example. But other than that, I don't know much about the reaction. I've been sort of busy with other stories today.
Do you have any idea what people said in those comment sections?
Anything
worth repeating?
No. No, not that I can think of.
You know, you said this is a story that has been out there for a while. Now, how come it seems like it's really first breaking today if it's been out there?
Right. So the Walker administration has been looking at this idea for well over a year. And the initial report from Deloitte came out in October of 2012, although I don't think people really knew about it until early this year. And then it was this January that essentially a second report was requested to look further at this. And that's when I started hearing about it from some health plans. But it was sort of unclear how serious this proposal was, at least to me, until we heard about the meeting today.
Now, would you say this is a neutral sort of cost-saving venture that Governor Walker is looking into right now? Or is this a way of, you know, maybe a state thumbing its nose at the Affordable Care Act?
Yeah, I can't really, you know, it's hard for me to decide about that. Certainly, you know, it was interesting that the meeting happened to happen today on the day that the exchanges are open. But and certainly part of the reason, part of the motivation for doing this, according to these reports, is to avoid that fee from the Affordable Care Act. But, you know, obviously 20 other states have done this, and presumably several of them did this long before the law was passed. So, you know, that's not the only motivation to do it. You can theoretically save some administration costs, too. So, you know, it might be something for states to look at.
David, do you know what the timeline is for this and what we might expect to happen next?
Yeah, so a committee of the Group Insurance Board, which oversees this, is likely going to take up a piece of this October 11th. And the recommendation to them from this consultant is that they request more formal proposals from companies that would help administer this kind of program, and then there would be more sort of hard data to go on to see if indeed this really could save money in certain parts of the state.
All right. Well, so, David, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay. Well, thank you.
We've been talking to David Wahlberg, the health and medicine reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal.
Coming up next, we'll take a look at the unsung heroes of the dinosaur world. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, Rob, you're thinking about dinosaurs.
Right.
What image pops into your head?
I'm probably like a lot of folks, you know, a T-Rex, maybe a Brontosaurus, you know, submerged in a lake.
So predictable, Ferret.
Yeah. Well, what about you?
Same thing.
Yeah. Predictable.
Well, our next guest says science has actually learned a lot more from less famous dinosaurs. He calls them the unsung heroes of the dinosaur world.
Brian Sweetek is with us now. He's a science writer and blogger. He's the author of My Beloved Brontosaurus, On the Road with Old Bones, New Science, and Our Favorite Dinosaurs. We've got an article he wrote linked on our Facebook page. Brian, welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be here.
So first, how did T-Rex get to be the rock star of the dinosaur world?
Well, the way it sort of was from the very beginning, I mean, first of all, Tyrannosaurus Rex, that would be one of the best names ever coined in the history of science. It's incredibly evocative. But it was named in 1905 by Henry Fairfield Osborne. The following year, the American Museum of Natural History was starting to put up a second skeleton. The second one is a more complete one that had been found in Montana. They only had the hips and the legs put up. And the New York Times ran this article saying it was the prize fighter of antiquity, and you know, nothing had ever been so fierce and so wonderful. So before people even really saw what this dinosaur was, just the fact that it was this giant carnivore bigger than anything that had ever been seen just established it as the, you know, killer dinosaur of all time, and it's just had a cultural momentum ever since then. Basically, it got into museums first and was really famous, and nothing has really been able to overshadow its reputation.
Got there first and good press. And now what about the other one we mentioned, the Brontosaurus? As I understand it, that's not even a real thing anymore.
Yeah, about the time that Tyrannosaurus was going up at the AMNH, Brontosaurus was scientifically dead. A paleontologist by the name of Elmer Riggs actually figured out that the dinosaur known as Brontosaurus should properly be called Apatosaurus. That is basically a double name. It was a synonym for one that had been named a few years earlier. But for whatever reason, it just stuck in museum halls. When museums put up their own skeletons of this, you know, long-necked dinosaur properly called Apatosaurus, they used the old name for reasons that aren't entirely clear. And because that was there, and because it became a kind of shorthand for the public, you know, Brontosaurus stayed on for decades in the public imagination until they found the long-lost skull of Apatosaurus in the late 1970s. The big image change finally happened. But yeah, I mean, that was, it's basically a dinosaur zombie just kind of shuffling along in museum halls until this correction was made.
Is it a thing like when they said Pluto's not a planet? Did we have a lot of very upset kids around the country clinging to the Brontosaurus?
See, most of the outcry that I've seen are actually from adults and people of my generation, and not so much. I mean, kids love it. Kids actually love the fact, like, you know, Pluto's not a planet anymore. They love to show up, adults. They love to show us up in terms of, you know, how they're really on point. It's mostly, like, a few years ago in 2010, there was a proposal that a dinosaur called Torosaurus, this three-horned, large, frilled dinosaur, was the adult form of Triceratops. And Triceratops was named first. So if this was true, if Torosaurus really was the adult form of our favorite Triceratops, and Triceratops would remain the name. But there's this huge public outcry, this huge misunderstanding, thinking that paleontologists were going to take Triceratops away. And people were comparing it to Pluto, saying this is just Pluto and Brontosaurus all over again, when really that wasn't anything at all to worry about. So I think, if anything, it's us who remember our childhood dinosaurs, remember the dinosaurs that we grew up with, that get most upset about this.
Well, the piece you wrote that prompted us giving you a call is about the dinosaurs that maybe aren't the household names that we've learned a lot from. And let's just go through them in the order of how hard they are to pronounce. And if we run out the clock, I won't have to say the really hard ones. Myasora. What have you learned from Myasora?
Well, that dinosaurs might be good parents. I mean, Myasora translates to, you know, caring mother lizard, and that was one of the sort of iconic aspects of this animal that was found in the late 1970s, is that it wasn't just the single skeleton or even fragments of a skeleton that paleontologists so often find, is this vast nesting ground. You know, contain not only eggshell, but, you know, hatchlings, infants, all the way up through adults. And previously, dinosaurs were thought to be kind of, well, basically poor parents. They just laid the eggs and they left them and kind of left nature sorted out. This was really good evidence, especially based upon the sort of development of the juveniles, that dinosaurs were, you know, attentive and caring parents, at least early in the lives of their offspring. You have this major image shift, and, you know, the dinosaur got a little bit of fame. I remember a children's book about it, but, you know, sort of things like The Land Before Time and other sort of films where we see the caring parent dinosaurs, that's based off of Myasora.
And the previous thought, as you mentioned, was that dinosaurs are kind of fire and forget with their eggs. They dropped them, moved on, hope for the best.
Yeah. I mean, that still seems like it might be the case for some. Not all dinosaurs are exactly the same. I mean, we're dealing with, you know, over 1,000 different genera of animals over millions and millions of years, but at least raise the possibility that dinosaurs weren't as crummy parents as had always been believed.
Well, it seems like over time, as we find more and more fossils and fossil evidence, the story keeps getting more and more complicated as we see more dinosaurs. Obviously, there must have been diversity in their behavior, their appearance, everything about them.
Absolutely, just like the modern world today. I mean, there are lizards that live in the American Southwest that are entirely different species, but they're geographically sort of differentiated in different colors. So it's things that are that subtle that must have existed among dinosaurs as well. I mean, there are over 50 skeletons of the dinosaur that we call T-Rex going over 2 million years of history. Chances are, if we could see the living animals, if we could see them, you know, really biologically and not just through the fossil record, there might have been multiple species. They might have been differentiated by color or certain things of behavior, but we can't quite get at that. We just have the bones. But even with just the bones, you know, differentiating one species from another on the basis of, you know, anatomy, different kinds of dinosaurs that we never knew existed before. It's really, you know, it's changing in an extremely rapid clip. I mean, a new dinosaur is named, I think, on the average of every 2 weeks.
Wow.
And most of them are as yet undiscovered. So really, we're still just getting to know what dinosaurs were, much less their biology.
Well, let's get to some of the other unsung heroes. Correct me on the pronunciation, Deinonychus?
Yeah. That one, there's a couple of variations, but that was the inspiration for Velociraptor in Jurassic Park. So Deinonychus, I guess, is the way that I usually go with it. Deinonychus also works. But this is a dinosaur that stood about as tall as, you know, the average human. It had this really distinctive switchblade claw on its foot and totally changed the image of what a dinosaur could be. This was dinosaurs found in 1969 in Montana. And at that time, dinosaurs were still kind of slow and stupid and swamp-bound and relatively drab and all that interesting. They were seen as basically larger variations of lizards, which were seen as basically just boring little reptiles. So Deinonychus, when this was discovered by paleontologist John Ostrom out of Yale, he immediately saw this could not be a slow-moving, stupid animal. It had to be active. It had all the anatomical hallmarks of an animal. It was actively running down prey, probably had a hot running metabolism, was very bird-like, and provided the idea, now fact, that birds are dinosaurs. So this was really, if there's any singular dinosaur that totally changed the image of what a dinosaur was and sort of ushered in the modern image of dinosaurs, it would be Deinonychus.
And with that metabolism you mentioned, does that mean they were what we lay people would call warm-blooded?
Yeah, or at least much more like birds, which are living dinosaurs and mammals like us, than the traditional image of sort of lizards and snakes and crocodiles. For a long time, dinosaurs were just seen as larger versions of the small reptiles we see around us today. But even though sort of many things about their physiology are still a mystery, all the hallmarks that paleontologists have been able to sort of pull out of their bones point to animals that must have had some way of being incredibly fast-growing, maintaining a high and active body temperature, being, they said, much more like, you know, birds and their you know, living dinosaurian descendants than anything that researchers expected before.
All right, another species you mentioned, Hadrosaurus?
Yeah, Hadrosaurus, that one's from my old home state of New Jersey, one of the most important dinosaurs ever found and often sort of overlooked because there's not very much of it. It was found before New Jersey kind of paved over all its fossil sites, which is a rather unfortunate thing. One of the last ones remaining is actually behind a Target off a highway, and that's the only one left from this particular era. But Hadrosaurus is one of these large herbivorous shovel-beaked hadrosaurs. It gave its name to the entire group, similar to Mayasaura. And it was one of the first dinosaurs known from a partial skeleton. Previously, all the bones that had been found in the early to mid-19th century were just, you know, scraps of jaw, a tooth here or there, a couple limb bones, and these were all put into sort of the form of iguanas or crocodiles or other familiar reptiles. Paleontologists could tell that these were from some kind of reptile, but they had no clue what the whole thing looked like, so they kind of just made their best guess based upon living reptiles. Hadrosaurus showed that dinosaurs were something unique and totally different, and, you know, in this particular case, the Hadrosaurus had shorter forelimbs than hind limbs, so it changed sort of ideas about posture and how they walked and how they moved, that they weren't sort of sprawling and squatting on the ground, but walking with this erect gait, and sort of was the first move to what we would consider sort of the modern image of the dinosaur.
All right, here's the one I was fearing, Cynoceropteryx.
You did there. Very good. Yeah, yeah, so Cynoceropteryx. This is a little sort of chicken-sized dinosaur, and the amazing thing about it, the greatest thing about it, is that it's fuzzy. It has this sort of almost mane of proto-feathers running down its back. So I meant we were talking about Deinonychus a moment ago. John Ostrom and you know, other paleontologists, on the basis of that, on the basis of just the bones, say these dinosaurs are very, very bird-like. Maybe birds are dinosaurs. And one of the missing bits was, well, where are the feathers if birds were dinosaurs? Feathers probably evolved sometime amongst the dinosaurs. If this connection is real, where are they? Well, in 1996, Sinosauropteryx shows up and confirms that connection was really the beginning of this flood of feathery fossils coming out of China and elsewhere around the world. And the amazing thing about this is beyond sort of confirming the bird-dinosaur connection, showing that, you know, many of them were covered in fluff and fuzz and feathers and these really weird body coverings, is that it gives us a way to finally discover dinosaur color by zooming in on these fossilized feathers and comparing them to the feathers of modern birds. Paleontologists can reconstruct what colors these dinosaurs were. And as a kid, I was always told we never ever knew that. So, you know, beyond just changing the image, it's literally changing sort of the art and the visions that we have of these animals.
So in our last minute or so, for these things that were around 65 million years ago and longer, they're changing every darn day. Why? That's got to be exciting to watch.
Oh, absolutely. It's incredibly fluid and dynamic science. And every time someone comes up with an idea, someone might dispute that or come up with another explanation or something like that. So really finding dinosaurs, the sort of Indiana Jones stuff that, you know, we love and I love to volunteer to do out in the field, that's just the beginning. Finding dinosaurs is just step one. And we're finding more and more from the remains than ever before. And every day, that's changing our image of what dinosaurs are really like.
Brian, thanks a lot for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Brian Sweetek. He's a science writer, author of My Beloved Brontosaurus. We have a link to the article he wrote about the unsung dinosaur heroes. You can find it at our Facebook page. That's Central Time on WPR.
Rob, were you actually trying to walk like a dinosaur during
that interview? I was. I was kind of like, they thought they waddled this way, but then they learned they walk upright. Yeah,
that's what
yeah,
I
that
saw.
That was it.
All right, we'll post video of that tomorrow. Well, speaking of tomorrow, coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Dr. Neil Barnard joins the show to share advice on nutrition and brain health.
On a related note, we'll hear about the novel cure, what novels to read when we're feeling sick, sad, or out of sorts.
And we'll get a look at college football. Our guest tackles the glories and scandals of the sport.
That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, UW-Madison was rated the number two party school in the nation, but a lot of people aren't celebrating. They say the rating puts the spotlight on a problem of college binge drinking. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.